Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, December 1st. We're going to finish up respiratory chapter today, maybe move into urinary system today. We'll take a look at the schedule in just a second after I get all these mics positioned just the way they should be. Okay, I think that works. Good enough? I think so. All right, let me turn some lights down like these and these. Oh, no, that's the wrong way, like that. All right, so let's take a look at the schedule. There's not much left to it. So slide all the way down to the bottom. And indeed, today is December 1st, and we're going to finish up respiratory, start urinary system, and then next week we'll talk about diversification system. And then after that, on Thursday, December 10th, is your last exam. And it's going to cover chapters 14, 16, 17, and 20 only, just those chapters, right? There might be something from the digestive system, but that is online instruction and testing only. It won't be on this lecture exam. All right, does anybody have a question regarding the schedule? No? Okay, so December 1st today. All right, I'll put the schedule away. And we got pretty far in respiratory chapter, and this is where I'm going to take up where we left off. And pointer options, arrow options visible. We are good. All right, so these, we talked about the spirometry readings and what you have to know about that. And so that's going to take us now to factors affecting gas exchange, unless somebody wants to review that spirometer information. Spirometry, we're good with that? Okay. Factors affecting gas exchange. Well, where is this going to happen? Where does gas exchange take place in terms of the cardiovascular system? Does it take place in the heart? Take place in an artery? Take place in a vein? It takes place in a capillary someplace, right? A capillary, because that's the only kind of vascular structure where exchange can take place because capillaries are thin. All right, so we're going to always be thinking about a capillary. And when we say gas exchange, things are going to move. And how are things going to move? From high concentration to low concentration passively, or from high pressure to low pressure passively? And if you want to go the other way, then that would be an active process that would require energy. All right, so we're talking about gases and not solutions anymore. So remember, the components of a solution would be the solvent and solutes. And a gas is a little bit different. It doesn't have any kind of solute component to it, but it's more of a mixture of things that are very similar. So it's a mixture of solutions together. And so there is something called partial pressure. And so if we have a mixture of gases, partial pressure is equal to the pressure that just one individual type of molecule will exert on that compartment. And according to Dalton's law, says that the total pressure of a gas is just going to be the sum of all the partial pressures that make it up. So these are almost like concentration, but not exactly the same. So if we were to measure pressure in the room, it's going to be very close to 760 millimeters of mercury. And so if we think of a tube that's 760 millimeters long and fill it with mercury, then it would exactly balance out the pressure of air that is pushing it up from the bottom. All right, so atmospheric pressure we know to be 760, and there are a number of components that make the gas that we breathe. Mostly it's nitrogen. There's some oxygen, some CO2, very little CO2, and then water. So you think you're breathing in water right now? What does that depend on? We're not underwater, but air has humidity, right? So there is water in air as a gas, as a vapor. And since it's a gas, we have to consider that partial pressure as a component of everything that has to equal 760 millimeters of mercury. Okay, so here is a picture of an alveolus, and this just represents, the second column here just represents what we find in air. And then the first column over here is just what component we're considering. So as far as water is concerned, if it's humid, then this Pressure increases. If it's very dry, then it might be very close to zero on inspired air. And nitrogen, 601 millimeters of mercury. Oxygen, 150 millimeters of mercury. And look at the concentration of CO2. It's very, very, very small. And so these compounds will move by diffusion from inside your body to outside, or outside to inside. And since the concentration of CO2 is almost zero outside your body, which way will it have a tendency to diffuse? Since you're producing CO2 all the time, from inside to outside, there's a big concentration gradient. Same thing for oxygen. There's relatively low oxygen inside your body, it's high outside, so that concentration gradient is going to drive oxygen inside for your respiratory purposes. After we inspire that air into an alveolus, the temperature has changed, the components of these compounds have changed, right? Because as it's moving through the trachea and bronchi, bronchioles, it becomes humidified, so that water vapor component increases. We see it goes up to about 50. And since your body is producing CO2, the CO2 partial pressure increases as well. All right, so that means something else has to change, right? Because right at the end of inspiration, the pressure in your lungs, your pulmonary space, has to equal the pressure outside, which is 760. So if CO2 increased, water vapor increased, that means other things have to decrease in order to add up to 760. And it's easy to see that oxygen decreases because we absorb that oxygen, and nitrogen goes down by a little bit as well. All right, so think of a mixture of gases as an addition of all of their partial pressures together. So gas exchange in an alveolus, we talked about an alveolus, and there is a nice, very extensive capillary network surrounding the alveolus, and so that enhances exchange. And we talked about the shape of an alveolus and how many there are and what kind of surface area that's available for exchange. Does anybody remember what the surface area was if we add up all of these alveoli? Yeah, half of a tennis court. Right, and so all of that half of a tennis court has been folded or rolled up into these alveoli, so it fits inside our thoracic cavity. That's really nice. What is not shown on this particular slide, which is too bad, your anatomy book shows it really nicely. Not only is there a network of capillaries around an alveolus, but there is an extensive network of elastic fibers around every alveolus, which is really important because as soon as these alveoli expand, and the tension that causes expansion stops, then the alveolus is going to go back down to its regular size, and that's going to force air out of the lungs. And indeed, quiet breathing, when you inhale, it's pretty much just due to the diaphragm. For quiet breathing, when you exhale, it's just completely passive, and the elastic properties of the muscles and around each alveolus expels air from our thoracic cavity. All right, when I look at this tube right here, I don't see any cartilage. I just see smooth muscle. All right, so that can't be a bronchus. That's got to be a bronchiole. And bronchioles can constrict or dilate depending on the state of contraction of these smooth muscles. And you know what kind of receptor is on these smooth muscles right here? Who can tell me? Is it a cholinergic or adrenergic? Adrenergic. And is it an alpha or beta? That's a beta. And is it a beta 1 or beta 2? It's a beta 2. And is a beta 2 excitatory or inhibitory? It's inhibitory, that's right. Because when epinephrine or norepinephrine bind to these beta 2 receptors, it inhibits these smooth muscles, they relax, bronchioles dilate, and according to Poiseuille's law, then the flow through this tube is enhanced greatly. Or if there is bronchospasm, if these muscles contract, then according to Poiseuille's law, then the resistance increases very much, very, very rapidly, according to the fourth power rule, and it's difficult to ventilate when that happens. Okay, so those beta 2 receptors are really handy sometimes to stimulate. Sometimes we have respiratory bronchioles because they have this primary structure for exchange, and that is an alveolus. So this tube right here kind of looks like a bronchiole, but it also kind of looks like it has components of an alveolar sac or an alveolus. So exchange can take place within a respiratory bronchiole because there's capillaries that surround the alveoli that are attached to it. These alveoli are connected to each other, sometimes by large ducts that I see within the alveolar sac, and sometimes by smaller pores between one alveolus and another one. So when there's a difference in pressure, air can flow into each of these alveoli. Okay, so capillaries for exchange. The rate of blood flow. Okay, let's answer some of these questions. How many chambers does the heart have? Four, thank you. Yeah, it has four. Okay, I'm not sure exactly what I heard, but you should know it's four. How many valves does the heart have? How many sides does the heart have? Two. How many circulations are there in the body? Two. And those are, give me the two names, systemic and pulmonary circulation. Right, so those are the two circulations. And the amount of blood that flows through the systemic circulation has to equal the amount of blood flowing through the pulmonary circulation, or blood is going to back up someplace. Right, so that's what this statement says. Rate of blood flow through pulmonary circuit equals flow through the systemic circulation. And what do you know blood flow to be? If we want to write an equation for blood flow, how are we going to write this equation? A really nice, basic, simple equation. Blood flow is equal to, okay, so a fluid will flow from one place to another based on a pressure gradient or pressure difference, right? So blood flow is going to be equal to pressure, but what's going to slow it down? Resistance, right? So we just put that in the numerator just like that. All right, so let's just put blood flow for the systemic circulation is equal to the pressure in the systemic divided by resistance in the systemic circulation. And then we're going to have blood flow for the pulmonary circulation is going to be equal to what? Pressure in the pulmonary circulation divided by resistance in the pulmonary circulation. And what can you tell me about BF sub S and BF sub P? They got to be equal to each other. All right? So BF sub S has got to be equal to BF sub P, and we know that to be P S divided by RS is equal to P sub P divided by RP. All right, so we know what the pressure is in the systemic circulation. Let's just say it's average about 100 millimeters of mercury, right? It's 120 over 80. All right, so we're going to put maybe just 100 millimeters of mercury over here, and we want the resistance in the systemic circulation to be high because these are long vessels, right? And then we're going to have over here pressure. I'm just going to leave it like that and see where we end up. And down here for R sub P, we're going to say low. All right, but if the flow has to be the same, okay, so if we have 100 divided by a large number, right, we get some kind of quantity. But if we divide 100 by low, can you see that this number is a lot larger? And so that won't work because these numbers on either side of the equation have to equal each other. So how does your body compensate? By making sure that these two sides of the equation balance out. What has to happen to P sub P? Okay, if we decrease resistance, what has to happen to pressure in order for this thing to remain constant? All right, if we decrease resistance, we have to decrease pressure to keep it the same number. Okay, and so that's exactly what we see in the pulmonary circulation. All right, the pressure in the pulmonary circulation is very low compared to systemic circulation because the flow has to be the same. So if resistance decreases, pressure has to decrease in order to keep the same flow through both of those circulations. All right, so that's what this other statement is. All right, so blood pumped through the pulmonary circulation is about 15 millimeters of mercury versus 100 for the systemic circulation. All right, that's really, really a lot different. And that's because pulmonary vascular resistance is low because those blood vessels are very short. And actually, that's very handy because pressure in a capillary is going to force fluid out of a capillary into tissue spaces, right? And what is that condition called when fluid builds up in tissue spaces? That's edema, right? You start to swell up. But because the pulmonary circulation pressure is so low, there is very little pressure pushing fluid out of the vascular system into interstitial spaces in the lung, right? And so it is easier for the respiratory membrane to work, right? This low pressure produces less net filtration than in systemic capillaries, and that avoids pulmonary edema. And if your lungs become full of water, then of course the alveoli cannot expand, and so you can't get air into an alveolus, and so that's going to decrease your pulmonary function. But because the pressure is so low, you don't have that problem of edema within the lungs. Now here's something strange. I'm not sure I mentioned this yet. Pulmonary arterioles constrict where alveolar PO2 is low and dilate where high. All right, so this is some kind of control mechanism. Is it extrinsic or intrinsic? Intrinsic, right? So in this particular situation, it is a metabolite or a molecule involved with metabolism that is regulating vasoconstriction or vasodilation of arterioles. And this is kind of strange because what do you know about that local control for a systemic arteriole? When does a systemic arteriole or a precapillary sphincter dilate in the systemic circulation, like within a muscle when it's exercising? Okay. When ATP is low? When ADP is high? I like that. Okay, lactic acid high. And all kind of means what? Oxygen is low. Right, so local control in the systemic circulation, right, tells us that when PO2 is low, then those vessels dilate in systemic circulation. But in the pulmonary circulation, those blood vessels constrict, right? It goes the other way, right? Because if there is no oxygen or if there's very little oxygen in an alveolus, then there's no reason why blood should go to that alveolus because the whole job is to go and pick up oxygen. Right, so those arterioles will constrict when that happens. So the local control is exactly opposite. Right, so this kind of local control matches ventilation to perfusion so that some area of the lung that is not being ventilated, that is low in oxygen, blood is not going there, blood is diverted to parts of the lung that have high oxygen, which then allows for that blood to pick up oxygen. And just remember, pulmonary circulation, local control is exactly the opposite. Where the systemic circulation resistance decreases with low PO2, in the pulmonary circulation with low PO2, the resistance increases. Right? And that just impedes blood flow to parts of the lung that don't have oxygen. If we look at the lungs, here's the apex, here's the base, right? And if we just think of pressure, right, there's more blood that goes to the base than to the apex, just because gravity is pulling it down. But when you breathe in, okay, it's the apex over here that gets most of the air, right? The apex fills up with air first before it goes down all the way to the base. And we want to think of a ventilation perfusion ratio. So ventilation is just the amount of air that's moving in and out of the lungs, and perfusion is the amount of blood that's going through that particular area. And we can make a ratio out of these things to come up with an index to indicate what the proper blood flow match to airflow is. And we call that ventilation perfusion ratio. So most of the lung has a proper ventilation perfusion ratio, but in the apex, okay, we see that it is overventilated and underperfused. Fortunately, that's a small part of the lung. And then down at the base where there's a lot of blood and little air, right, then the ventilation to perfusion ratio is really low because there's more fluid down here, more blood compared to air that is entering. But most of the lung, because of that local control, works very, very nicely. Okay. Control of ventilation. All right. Well, here we see cerebrum, pituitary gland, cerebellum, and we have this bulge right here, which is the pons, right? And then down below it towards the spinal cord, here's the medulla. And these are parts of the brain that control a lot of functions in your body automatically, like blood pressure and heart via the cardioregulatory center, vasomotor center. But it also controls automatic breathing. Now, I don't want to say autonomic breathing, right? We just want to say automatic. It can happen without your conscious thought. And usually when we think of something happening without your conscious thought, we call that involuntary. But the muscles that cause inspiration are skeletal muscles, like the diaphragm. And what do you know about skeletal muscles? Are they voluntary or involuntary? They're voluntary. So there is a special system that can take over, right, the diaphragm and other muscles of inspiration, depending on the needs of oxygen and excess CO2 in your body. And these are the centers. So there's three centers. There's a rhythmicity area in the medulla, and there's two other centers in the pons, the apneustic and pneumotaxic area. And the rhythmicity center has nerves for inspiration and nerves for expiration, and there are pacemakers in each of these different locations, right? And so there's a certain pace where inspiratory muscles are excited and then inhibited with a pacemaker for the inhibitory neurons, right? And that sets the overall pace and depth of respiration. All right, these centers right here in the apneustic area, these will excite the inspiratory muscles, right? So that will cause inspiration. The neurons in the pneumotaxic area will inhibit the excitatory neurons in the apneustic area. Right, so there is some kind of antagonistic control in terms of regulating automatic breathing, for instance, like when you're asleep, because this rhythmicity center has its own pacemakers for inspiration, but it's also adjusted by other things that take place in the pons. The inspiratory neurons of the rhythmicity center stimulate the spinal motor neurons. Right, so how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system to a skeletal muscle? Only one, right? So only one. So those inspiratory neurons are stimulated, okay, from the rhythmicity center. And when you're breathing quietly, for instance, when you're sleeping, expiration is passive, right? You just relax muscles. Elastic properties of the alveolus and skeletal muscle then cause expiration to take place. All right, we talked about the apneustic and pneumotaxic area, and I want to go to this diagram right here. All right, so here is a pretty nice flow diagram that shows how breathing is controlled. So we looked at the medulla oblongata, and remember the rhythmicity center is in the medulla, maybe jot that down on your notes, and the pons has the apneustic and pneumotaxic area. The pons can be influenced by the cerebral cortex, right, depending on chemical conditions in the brain. The pons, remember, can influence the medulla. And this diagram is okay, but I wrote on the board one that makes a little bit more sense to me. So let's take a look at that. So it's exactly the same diagram that's in your notes, but just a little bit different. It might describe the situation some. All right, so here is cerebral cortex, pons, medulla, spinal cord. All right, spinal cord is going to have those motor neurons that go to the diaphragm, for instance, for inspiration. All right, so here's the pons. The pons has two areas, the pneumotaxic and apneustic area. We know that the apneustic area in the pons is excitatory for inspiration. And we said that the pneumotaxic area in the pons will inhibit the apneustic area, right? So I like to see a nice minus sign right here for pneumotaxic and a nice plus sign for the apneustic area. And then that influences the medulla. So I don't like apneustic and pneumotaxic going to the same place because they have to go through each other, right? The pneumotaxic information has to influence the rhythmicity center by adjusting the apneustic area. So it's got to go through that apneustic area. The pons gets information, chemical information, from receptors, central receptors that are in the brain, and peripheral receptors that are in certain blood vessels, like the carotid sinus and arch of the aorta. I've got a picture that I can show you in just a little bit. Okay, the cerebral cortex also can influence motor neurons in the spinal cord. Like we can all, because the diaphragm is voluntary muscle, we can't hold our breath for as long as we want to until we pass out, right? And then we lose conscious control. When we lose conscious control, what happens? Then the automatic control takes over, right? So if you pass out, then people will start breathing anyway. Did you ever do that when you were a kid? Anybody ever do that to freak your parents out? No? Okay. Well, I give you permission to freak me out sometime if you want to hold your breath. And it would be really cool if the whole class did it at one time. Okay. And then you all would wake up. So I like this diagram just a little bit better. Okay. Did you see that? Just this one little modification right here. All right. So let's go back and take a look. Okay, we talked about these apneustic and pneumotaxic areas. All right, so here is the system we were looking at, right? Chemoreceptors. There are central chemoreceptors in the medulla, and there are peripheral chemoreceptors that are in the arch of the aorta, right? And then up over here, this is the bifurcation of the common carotid into the external and internal carotid, and there's a little bit of a swelling in this blood vessel right there. So there are also pressure receptors in this area, but right now we're talking about chemoreceptors for monitoring various chemicals. Okay. And chemoreceptors can measure CO2, oxygen, and also pH, which is hydrogen ion, in these areas. All right. Well, what has a major influence on ventilation? Right, so these chemoreceptors modify ventilation. They change your inspiratory pattern and depth of inspiration in order to maintain CO2 and oxygen and pH at levels that are suitable to support life. Right, so that just for maintaining homeostasis in your body. And so what would you think would be the most crucial molecule that your body would want to measure? Which one do you need to make ATP? What do you need to make ATP? You need oxidative phosphorylation to make a lot of ATP that requires oxygen, right? So oxidative phosphorylation requires oxygen. I would have always thought that oxygen would be the most important molecule to monitor because that's what's going to influence ATP production. But that's not how it works, right? Carbon dioxide is the most important molecule for regulating ventilation because of the following equation. Here we have carbon dioxide. It can combine with water to produce carbonic acid. Carbonic acid will dissociate very rapidly into hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. What is hydrogen ion right here? That is going to make the solution much more acidic, right? That's going to decrease the pH. So if we increase CO2, what happens to pH, or what happens to bicarbonate? According to Le Chatelier's principle, right, if CO2 increases, that's going to force the reaction to the right, and that's going to increase hydrogen ion concentration, make something more acidic, or decrease the pH. And we know our bodies are very sensitive to pH. All the biochemistry is very sensitive to pH. All right, so when we add CO2 to a system, that decreases the pH, makes it more acidic. And it can go the other way as well. Well, there's an enzyme that's necessary to make this happen rapidly, right? The free energy of these molecules is all the same. They can go backwards and forwards. And I see that double-ended arrow right there. It does. Does anybody remember the name of the enzyme that speeds up this reaction so that it's almost instantaneous? It's called carbonic anhydrase. Carbonic anhydrase. Maybe that's ringing a bell because we've talked about it before. Right. Hyperventilation, when we breathe rapidly, right, causes low carbon dioxide in our body because we're breathing it out very rapidly. We call that hypocapnia. Hypocapnia means low CO2. If we hold our breath or hypoventilate, that causes high CO2 or hypercapnia. Right, so capnia just has to do with CO2 levels, hypo or hyper. Right, and so you got to know the name of the enzyme that interconverts, right, carbon dioxide with hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. Right, so if you're in your body, right, you're producing CO2, and that CO2 increases pH. That CO2, now that blood gets to the lungs, and you breathe CO2 out of your body. Right, so CO2 over here is going to decrease. What happens to the hydrogen ion concentration when we exhale CO2? Hydrogen ion will combine with bicarbonate and try to replace that CO2 that you have lost from your body. And when that happens, what happens to the pH when you lose hydrogen ions? It goes up, right? So if you hold your breath, right, when you hold your breath, CO2 goes up. That increases the acidity of your body. When you hyperventilate, you lose more CO2. That decreases the pH of your body. So just by breathing is one mechanism of adjusting pH. So a respiratory alkalosis, right, is when you hold your breath. A respiratory acidosis, okay, is when you hyperventilate. So certainly you can adjust the pH of your body, or your respiratory rate helps adjust the pH inside your body. And when we get rid of CO2, what is that like breathing out of your body? When you exhale CO2, when you breathe out CO2, that's like losing what chemical from your body? When you take away CO2, then hydrogen ion has to combine with bicarbonate to replace it. So when we exhale, it's like breathing acid out of your body. Do you see that? When you get rid of CO2, that's going to decrease hydrogen ion, which is going to increase the pH or decrease the acidity. So even, right, when we exhale, we're really breathing acid out of our body, like we all have alien breath or something. Right, and you got to know the enzyme that makes that happen very rapidly, carbonic anhydrase. All right, so let's look at the effects of CO2 and pH on ventilation. So if we decrease ventilation, try to think about what might happen to carbon dioxide levels. If we hold our breath, carbon dioxide is not leaving our body, so it's gonna accumulate inside of us. So we've got increased arterial pCO2, that's just the partial pressure of CO2. And when we increase carbon dioxide, what happens to pH? It becomes more acidic, right, according to the carbonic anhydrase reaction. And when your blood becomes more acidic, the chemoreceptors, and these are the peripheral chemoreceptors in the arch and the carotid sinus, right, will monitor that and send that information to the respiratory center, right, like a decrease in pH, right? When you see a decrease in pH, what does that mean in terms of carbon dioxide? An increase in CO2, right? So that's one way that the respiratory center knows that there is an increased level of CO2 because it can monitor pH via these peripheral chemoreceptors. All right, well, we go back to where we have a increased plasma CO2, and that blood is going to go into the brain, and it's going to decrease the pH of interstitial fluid in the brain, and that's going to affect the central chemoreceptors in the medulla oblongata. So if the pH decreases, right, in the medulla oblongata, what is the response of the respiratory center? To increase ventilation, right, to get rid of CO2, which is going to bring the pH back up when that happens. Right, so the respiratory center, that rhythmicity center, then can send signals down through the spinal cord to motor neurons to stimulate respiratory muscles to increase ventilation. Right, and what does that do to this initial stimulus? The initial stimulus is increasing CO2. What does increased ventilation do? It decreases carbon dioxide levels. So here is a nice negative feedback mechanism, right? These subtract from each other, maintaining proper levels of carbon dioxide and along with it, the proper pH inside of our body. And what's the enzyme that's really important for that? Carbonic anhydrase, right? Okay, the brain chemoreceptors are responsible to the largest degree for ventilation. All right, hydrogen ion, because it's an ion, has difficulty getting through the plasma membrane, right? Because hydrogen ions are polar compounds and only nonpolar compounds can go through a cell membrane. Right, so hydrogen ions can't cross the blood-brain barrier, but CO2 can, right? And that is the reason why CO2 is monitored very tightly and regulated very tightly to maintain homeostasis and metabolism inside of our body. Both the rate and depth of ventilation is adjusted to maintain a pCO2 of about this number right here, 40 millimeters of mercury. And I think maybe it's okay if you memorize that, because that's going to be on a graph that you should know. All right, so if the pCO2, okay, increases from 40 to 50 or 60, what happens to the pH in your body? So pCO2 increases, pH decreases because that increases acidity, right? The peripheral chemoreceptors don't respond to pCO2, but only to hydrogen ion levels. All right, so here we have a nice picture of the brain. Here is a capillary, right? And then here is the blood-brain barrier. There's a blood-brain barrier. Remember that hydrogen ions can't move across this barrier right here because they're polar. CO2 can, because it's not a polar compound. When CO2 enters the brain or cerebral spinal fluid, now it's past this blood-brain barrier, carbon dioxide will bind with oxygen, right, and produce bicarbonate and hydrogen ion via the carbonic acid. And what's the enzyme that makes this happen very rapidly? Yeah, carbonic anhydrase. So now we have these hydrogen ions inside the brain, and they can stimulate the chemoreceptor neurons in the medulla oblongata. Carbon dioxide, hydrogen ions itself in the blood can't get in, right? But carbon dioxide can. I think there's some end of chapter questions like that. All right, and if hydrogen ions increase, that will increase ventilation when that happens. Low blood oxygen, we call that hypoxemia, has little effect on ventilation, which is kind of surprising because that PO2 is what's responsible for driving oxidative phosphorylation, right? But it does influence chemoreceptor sensitivity to the partial pressure of CO2. But what has to happen, there has to be a drastic fall. PO2 has to fall to about half the normal before ventilation is significantly affected. That has some kind of startling effects, which maybe I'll mention in just a second. All right, that's not so important about emphysema. This is what I want to talk about. Many times, ventilation is stimulated by hypoxic drive rather than pCO2. All right, so what is hypoxic drive, or what is hypoxemia? What's hypoxemia? Hypoxemia is when there is very low oxygen inside the body, right? And if oxygen concentration drops very, very low, that's when it can influence the respiratory center, but only when the drop in partial pressure of oxygen is dramatic. Okay, only under dramatic conditions, under most conditions, oxygen has no bearing whatsoever on ventilation. Well, there are a number of times when somebody's brain is dead, okay, or certain parts of their brain like cerebrum, and they're put on a ventilator, and the ventilator then is bringing in oxygen to their body, removing CO2, and somebody has to make a decision, since this person dead or alive, should we take them off a ventilator or not? It's a very difficult decision. And maybe the decision is made to remove your loved one from the respirator, and then you kind of know like that's the end, but you're already aware that the person is gone when that happens. All right, so you stop the ventilator, and there are still some cells that utilize that oxygen. When somebody's taken off of a ventilator, even though their brain is dead, what happens to oxygen concentration? It still goes down. It starts to drop, right? And it drops to very, very low levels. And then the chemoreceptors for oxygen notice that there's a drastic drop in oxygen, and they'll stimulate a gasp reflex. All right, so even though somebody's dead, take them off a ventilator, after a certain period of time, they're going to go, and if you're not aware of that, right, and your loved one is starting to do that, what is your thought? Oh my God, they're trying to wake up, they're trying to come back, but it's what? It's just a reflex mechanism because oxygen has dropped below that critical threshold level, right? So they call that the gasp reflex. When somebody's taken off of a ventilator, we call that hypoxic drive, and that had nothing to do with CO2, just that drastic decrease in oxygen. All right, here is a table. We want to look at ventilation. We call it minute volume, how much air moves in and out of the lungs in a minute. Right? And so it's liters per minute over here. And we want to look at ventilation versus a change in carbon dioxide, which is the line on the top. And we also want to compare it to a change in oxygen concentration, which is the axis on the bottom. All right, so what's going to increase ventilation? A, increase in CO2, right? And that's the linear relationship that we see. So if we increase the concentration of CO2, that increases ventilation. And in terms of oxygen, what's going to increase ventilation? Not an increase in oxygen, but a decrease in oxygen, right? So the axes are going in opposite directions compared to CO2 and to oxygen. All right, well, let's change our ventilation. Let's double it, going from 20 to 40. So here's 20. What is the change in CO2 if we double the ventilatory rate from 20 to 40? So we go from about here, which is what, maybe about 4.5%, and then we go up to 40, which is 6. And so what's the change in percent carbon dioxide that produces a doubling in ventilatory rate? It is 1.5%. That's a pretty small number, right? So CO2 has a very powerful influence on ventilatory rate. So jot that down someplace. What did we say? Change of 1.5%, 1.5%. Let's do that same change for oxygen, right? So, well, oxygen, we can't even get up past 20. So let's start at 10. And if we double 10, where do we go? To 20. All right, so what has to happen? What change in oxygen happens when we double ventilatory rate? Well, we can pick 12%. And when does it double? Well, we can say over here around 6%. So what's the change in oxygen that doubles ventilatory rate? Okay, it's 6%. What was it for PCO2? 1.5%, right? So the CO2 is almost 6 times as sensitive, right, compared to oxygen. So oxygen concentration can change a lot without affecting ventilation. Carbon dioxide can only change a little bit. And even if it changes a little bit, like 1% or 1.5%, that still has a significant influence on ventilation. That's what this table here shows, right? That oxygen is not so important, but CO2 is in terms of controlling. Right, our lungs are pretty delicate tissue. And if the lungs were to overinflate, that would herniate the alveoli. It would rip alveoli, damage capillaries. So there is a special reflex called the Herring-Bruer reflex, right? And it's mediated by stretch receptors in the lungs. So as your lungs expand, these stretch receptors send information to the spinal cord, and when the lungs reach a certain level of expansion, that will stimulate inhibitory neurons to prevent overinflation of the lungs. So the Herring-Bruer reflex prevents overinflation of the lungs by inhibiting inspiration. So I think that's pretty easy to understand. Right, Herring-Bruer reflex prevents overinflation because it is possible to overinflate a very delicate tissue like the lungs. All right, well, let's look at how oxygen and CO2 are transported in the blood. Oxygen has difficulty dissolving in water. carbon dioxide is very happy to dissolve in water, right? But because oxygen doesn't like to dissolve in water, there has to be different ways that blood transports oxygen. And the way that it's done is that oxygen dissolves in blood and then it binds to hemoglobin, basically taking it out of solution, right? And then blood is transferred, then that oxygen is transported throughout your body bound to hemoglobin. Loading of hemoglobin with oxygen occurs in the lungs, right? And unloading in tissues. So oxygen is delivered from the lungs to the tissues. And so we want to look at the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen for a number of physiologic variables, like pH can change, or temperature can change, various things can change. All right, so here is a molecule of hemoglobin, right? And I can see the quaternary structure. There are actually four proteins that come together. Each one of those proteins has a pigment or a heme group in there, which is an iron molecule. And that iron molecule has a proper electrical charge so that an oxygen can bind to it. Right, so every hemoglobin molecule can bind four oxygens just by the way it's made. So hemoglobin, so here is the heme molecule. It's not a protein, it's not a lipid, it's not a sugar, but you can see it is an organic compound. It's a very big organic compound. It's difficult to synthesize and sometimes can be really difficult to get out of our body. All right, so let's compare how much oxygen can be carried by plasma alone compared to how much oxygen plasma plus red blood cells can carry. And that's what we call whole blood. So here we have a tank of oxygen, right, and a nice regulator, and we bubble oxygen through these two liquids, plasma versus whole blood, and we adjust the rate of these bubbles so that the oxygen partial pressure is 100 in both of these chambers. All right, so some oxygen does dissolve in plasma, and if we measure the amount of oxygen, we see that there are, at standard temperature and pressure, right, if we were to take all the oxygen out of this solution right here and put it in its own container, at standard pressure, it would be 0.3 millimeters for every 100 mLs of solution that we take out, right, 0.3. But when we have red blood cells at the same partial pressure in this solution over here, and then we take all the oxygen off the hemoglobins and put that in a container at standard temperature and pressure, we see that you have 20 mLs for every 100 ml of blood. So what is that? That's a 10, that's almost, it's over 100 times increase if you have hemoglobin transporting oxygen just compared to what, basically just a water solution. All right, so a simple water solution can't transport oxygen, and that's why the hemoglobin molecule has evolved. So hemoglobin greatly increases oxygen capacity, carrying capacity of blood. All right, so you can see it from these numbers right here. Hemoglobin can take a couple of different forms. Hemoglobin has an Fe in a plus 2 state. Sometimes that iron can be reduced to a 3 plus state, and we call that a ferric iron. That does not bind oxygen, and there's always some of this methemoglobin around, right? And so it just lacks that extra electron to bind oxygen. So, and blood has some little bit of this, but not very much. There's another molecule that can bind to hemoglobin besides oxygen, right, when it's in the ferrous state, and that is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide can form carboxyhemoglobin, and carboxyhemoglobin then is not available to transport oxygen because oxygen can't bind to it. The bond strength of carbon dioxide to hemoglobin is 210 times stronger than that of oxygen. And when that hemoglobin is bound with carbon monoxide, then it can't carry oxygen, and that's why carbon monoxide is a terrible poison, right? And one of the ways that you can help somebody with carbon monoxide poisoning, right, is to put them on a high oxygen mixture. So if we have hemoglobin right here, and it's bound to CO2, right, then oxygen can't bind to it. We can get that carbon dioxide off if we increase the oxygen concentration, right? So how many of these oxygen molecules would I have to draw here in order to have just a 50-50 chance of moving that carbon dioxide off of there? What's the affinity? 210 times, right? So I would have to draw in 210 of these oxygen molecules just to get equal concentrations of hemoglobin carrying oxygen. All right, so carbon monoxide has a very high affinity for hemoglobin, and that's why very low levels of carbon monoxide are poisonous and can be even over time. Very small levels of carbon monoxide over a long period of time is very, very dangerous. I haven't heard anybody die yet in Los Angeles of carbon monoxide poisoning, but in the United States and even in California, it happens every year. For instance, when somebody's heater malfunctions in their house, when they turn their furnace on to warm up their house, if it's not venting properly, and usually the heater is on at night, then carbon monoxide builds up in spaces and bedrooms and things like that, and people just don't wake up when that happens. Today, there are sensors that can monitor carbon monoxide, and it's probably a pretty good idea if you have a heater that runs on gas or some kind of hydrocarbon. That's a really good idea. Other times, some people will bring in a grill, a charcoal grill, to heat up their house, right? And anytime you burn some kind of organic compound, that produces carbon monoxide, and that's a really terrible thing too, because when you burn charcoal inside your house, carbon monoxide levels increase, and that's very poisonous, even very small levels of carbon monoxide. All right, let's take a look at this table here. Not so interesting, but because we want to plot this out to really see what's going on. So here is a bunch of numbers that tell us what the partial pressure of oxygen is in a solution and how that correlates to the amount of oxygen that binds to hemoglobin. We're going to call that the percent oxyhemoglobin. Right, so if the partial pressure of oxygen is 100, right, then almost all of the hemoglobin is bound with oxygen. Right, and as we decrease the partial pressure of oxygen, what happens to the percent oxyhemoglobin? It decreases as well. Right? We can't see really what's happening here, but I just want you to see there's a direct relationship. And if we plot it out, this is what the curve looks like. So this is an oxygen saturation curve. And you can actually get little apps, probably even free apps on your smartphones that can measure percent oxyhemoglobin saturation. All right, so what are some important things? Well, this is partial pressure of oxygen in blood vessels, and it's regulated, your respiration is regulated to maintain at least 40 millimeters of mercury in veins. That's the partial pressure of oxygen. And in arteries, it's going to be 100. Right? And I think maybe I asked you to memorize these things maybe on a previous slide. All right, so PO2 in veins is 40, PO2 in arteries is 100. And let's see what that means in terms of percent saturation. If we take that table and plot all those numbers out, this is the curve that we get, kind of a sigmoid-shaped curve. Well, if the PO2 in an artery is 100, what can you tell me about the percent saturation of hemoglobin? Really close to 100, 97, 98, 99, something like that, right, in a normal person. And we can even say 100, just for the purposes of discussion. So arterial blood is almost completely saturated with oxygen. When it gets into a vein, right, the partial pressure of oxygen decreases down to 40. And what's the percent saturation then? Maybe 75. Right, so the percent saturation went from 100 to 75. So that difference right there represents how much oxygen was delivered to tissues when that happens. Right, the vertical axis on the other side, right, instead of percent saturation, if we were to take those oxygen molecules and put them in a container and measure the volume at standard temperatures and pressure, right, milliliters of O2 for 100 milliliters of blood, Right, then we see the amount of oxygen unloaded in tissues is 5. Okay, 5 mLs at that particular standard temperature and pressure. So this, I do believe, is an exam figure. Right, so maybe I could ask you how much oxygen is unloaded in tissues. So I do want you to know this axis down here, or at least these two numbers, 40 and 100, right, for the exam. And maybe, what did I give you? Did anybody look at this exam figure yet? I can't remember if I erased these vertical numbers or not over here. Okay, but I would definitely want you to know that the PO2 in a vein is a lot less compared to an artery, and in arteries it's 100, and in a vein it's 40. Okay. Yeah. Okay, explain
oxygen content.
Oxygen content? Yeah. Okay, so over here, we just have blood, and we have red blood cells, and we have hemoglobin inside those red blood cells, and on that hemoglobin, we have 4 oxygen molecules, or at least a maximum can be 4. All right, so if we take that blood out, take a look at it from an artery, and remove all of the oxygen and just the oxygen, leave everything else in blood, and put that oxygen in a container, right? And let's just say we're taking all of that oxygen from 100 mLs of whole blood. What is the volume of oxygen gas that comes from 100 mLs of blood at standard temperature and pressure? What would be the volume? Right, if we increase the pressure, the volume would decrease. We increase the temperature, the volume would change. But just at standard conditions, what volume of oxygen is contained, right, in that volume of blood, 100 mLs? And we see that the volume of oxygen, right, is high when the percent saturation is high, and it starts to decrease when hemoglobin loses oxygen, right? The percent saturation decreases. And if we compare between venous blood and arterial blood, we can see the change in saturation, but that corresponds to a change in the amount of oxygen that is in the blood. All right, so if we look at that difference, then we see how much is unloaded, how much oxygen is picked up in the lungs, where we have arteries, right, and delivered to tissues, and after your oxygen is taken out, right, you're left with the vein. If we compare those two numbers, we know exactly how much oxygen a tissue has received from the blood, okay, at standard temperature and pressure, measured in mLs for the certain amount of blood, 100 mLs. Okay, so this represents the amount of oxygen that's actually delivered to tissues. If the partial pressure of oxygen in a vein was equal to the partial pressure in an artery, guess what would be the unloading into tissues? It would be 0, right? But because the partial pressure in a vein is a lot less, right, then there is unloading of oxygen into the tissues because tissues use up oxygen, right? So the partial pressure in veins has got to be lower. So that's just the amount that that tissue, okay, is taking up from hemoglobin that's in your blood. So this is a nice sigmoid-shaped curve. And this is under kind of standard conditions. Here is a table that shows what happens when we change the pH of blood. So what's a standard pH of blood? 7.38, something like that, 39. We can just say 7.4 is a normal condition. And under those conditions, right, if we go back, how much oxygen is unloaded into tissues? About 5 mLs, right? So I see 5 mLs, and do we see that in the table? Yeah, here it is right here, 5 mLs at normal blood pH. Well, when you exercise, what happens to blood pH? When you start to use a lot of skeletal muscles, what is produced? Lactic acid. Lactic acid is produced. What happens to pH? It decreases. So let's compare that number. Here is 7.4, which is normal. 7.2, this is in an acidic tissue, maybe it's a muscle that's exercising. When a muscle is exercising, does it make sense that blood should deliver more or less oxygen to it when a muscle is exercising? It makes sense that blood can deliver more oxygen to that tissue. And at 7.2, the affinity of oxygen to a hemoglobin is decreased. And if we just look at the two endpoints, arterial blood versus venous blood, we see that under acidic conditions, right, there is 6.6 mLs of oxygen delivered to that tissue compared to 5. Right, now, 6.6 compared to 5 doesn't look like much of a change, but in terms of a percent, what is that? That's over 20% increase. So that actually is a pretty big number. All right, well, what does that mean when we look at these oxygen binding curves? All right, stick with me. This is really easy, right, when I describe it to you. So here is percent saturation. Here is PO2. And we know what venous blood is about 40. Arterial blood is 100, right? And we see that here is the normal curve for oxygen saturation. Here is the curve when it becomes acidic, 7.2. So what happens to oxygen delivery under these particular conditions? Well, we would have to compare 40 versus 100. All right, so let's look at normal conditions. 40, what do we have? 75, yeah, I think we saw that before. And then at 100, right, it's still almost 100% saturated, so it is a change of 25% saturation. But under acidic conditions, what is it? At 100, it's still pretty close to 100% saturated, right? But going down this curve, when we get to 40, where's 40 at? Am I there yet? Oh, I just arrived. What is that? Instead of, what was it, 25%, what is it? It's a 40% change, right? So there's an increase in oxygen delivery to tissues when tissues become acidic compared to the lungs. Right, so if this curve ever shifts, which way is it shifting, to the right or to the left? From normal to pH, the shift is to the right. Right? Anytime you see a right shift in an oxygen saturation binding curve, that means, by definition, what? Better oxygen delivery to tissues, better unloading of oxygen to tissues. Right? A right shift means better unloading of oxygen into tissues. All right, so that's about the only thing that you have to memorize from this particular slide. There are some other things that can regulate oxygen unloading. And this is particularly useful. This is kind of a rapid mechanism. For instance, if you go from sea level to up in the mountain someplace where the partial pressure of oxygen decreases very rapidly, but you still want to deliver oxygen to your body, there is a chemical called 2,3-DPG, diphosphoglycerate. You can consider this a metabolite of glycolysis. There are metabolites of glycolysis that are very similar to this. Right? With low PO2, for instance, at high altitude, there's less oxygen in air that you're breathing, and there's going to be an increased level of 2,3-DPG. Right? Less oxygen, less inhibition of production of 2,3-DPG. So there's going to be an increased 2,3-DPG that lowers the affinity for hemoglobin, which produces a right shift. Right? If increasing 2,3-DPG produces a right shift in that oxygen binding curve, what does that mean for unloading in tissues? We don't need to plot it out. You just know it's a right shift. What does it do for unloading? Increases unloading to tissues, right? So this right shift increases oxygen unloading to tissues. And what was the initial stimulus? Was less oxygen delivery to tissues. So the stimulus and the response subtracts from each other, right? Nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining homeostasis, right? So just the metabolism inside this red blood cell, when it produces more 2,3-DPG, that assists unloading of oxygen or delivery of oxygen to tissues. And that can happen pretty quick. All right, so here is a table that kind of summarizes what we've been talking about. All right, when there is a decrease in pH, which means more acidic, what happens to affinity? It decreases. And what kind of shift is that? To the right. And if it's a right shift, what about unloading of oxygen? Increases, right? So under periods of maybe exercise, where pH decreases, that's a really nice mechanism for increasing oxygen delivery to tissues. That's called the Bohr effect. Right? So Bohr effect works on hydrogen ion concentration, increasing oxygen delivery during hypercapnia. Oh, what's hypercapnia again? Increasing CO2, like when a muscle is contracting, right? It's producing a lot of CO2. That's a hypercapnia in that blood that's in that muscle. All right. When there is an increase in 2,3-DPG, for instance, when you go up really high in altitude, right, and there's less oxygen in the air, that causes a decrease of affinity that shifts the curve to the right. And what does that do to oxygen delivery to tissues? If it's a right shift, increases oxygen unloading in tissues, right? So that helps somebody breathe at high altitude. Okay, increased temperature. When might your temperature increase? Exercise. I like that. I heard exercise someplace, right? When you exercise, what's a good measure of your temperature increasing? Well, you start to sweat, right? So your temperature increases when you're exercising. And what happens to oxygen delivery to tissues then? Well, the affinity is decreased. That shifts the curve to the right. And you know that to do what? Increase oxygen unloading into tissues, right, during exercise or even when somebody has a fever. Right, so these things, I think, really are make really good common sense. Right, decreasing pH, increasing temperature, 2,3-DPG, when oxygen concentration in the air we breathe decreases. Right, these all increase oxygen unloading into tissues because it produces a right shift in the oxygen saturation curve. All right, so that's how I look at that. All right, anybody have a question? You might have to go home and look at that a little bit. And if you have a question, write it down and bring it up in class next time. Unless you have a question right now. So if there is a right shift to the oxygen saturation binding curve, a right shift, what does that do to oxygen delivery to tissues? It increases, right? And that happens when pH decreases, temperature increases, or even when oxygen in the air we breathe decreases via 2,3-DPG increase. Okay. That's all you need to know about that. All right, here we have a picture of some red blood cells. On the left is normal. On the right is due to a sickle cell trait. When red blood cells go through a capillary, capillaries are very small. Usually there's only room for one red blood cell. Right? Even the red blood cell is probably bumping up against the walls of the capillary a little bit. So this kind of red blood cell can flow through a capillary pretty easily because it has the right shape. It's nice, smooth, and round. And they can even stack on top of each other very nicely and flow through very, very small blood vessels. Right? But this kind of red blood cell, because it's bulky in some regions and has these points over here, that's why we call it sickle cell, they have a tendency to get stuck in capillaries. They cannot flow. They can't stack very much, right? And they can get stuck in a capillary, and then that blocks off blood to that particular capillary. This is a genetically inherited disease, and the reason why it was selected for, because when people have a sickle cell trait, they have some protection against malaria and other kinds of blood diseases, right? So it is beneficial. But what can you tell me about the chromosomes? We've never talked about this, but maybe some of you have had a biology class. How many chromosomes do we have in our body? We've got 46, right? But there's a special arrangement of that 46. What's the special arrangement? You have them in pairs. You get 23 from your dad and 23 from your mom. And the number one from dad is almost exactly like the number one from your mom, but not like the number two or number three or number four. So you have two number ones, right? And in order for you to have this trait like this, you need to have the sickle cell trait both from your dad and your mom. But if you just get it from your dad or if you just get it from your mom, you don't have this condition, but you're protected from malaria, right? So there is some benefit for having that particular genetic trait, but not if you have that trait from both your mom and your dad. All right. So what does this do? Well, if blood can't get into a tissue, what does it feel like? Have you ever experienced that? I think we all have. Maybe you're watching TV, sleeping in bed, walking down the sidewalk, and all of a sudden you get a muscle cramp. Okay, we call that a spasm. Who's ever had a muscle cramp? Raise your hand if you had a muscle cramp. Everybody has, right? Okay, so I'm standing here lecturing, and all of a sudden my biceps goes into spasm. It turns into this nice placid muscle to this incredibly solid rock that blood can't get into. Okay, and so what am I going to do when that biceps goes into that severe contracture, that tetanus? Am I going to walk around the room and be really proud of that muscle? Or what am I going to do? I'm going to do anything to get that muscle to relax, because what's happening? How does it feel? Somebody said painful, but it really hurts like hell, right? It's really bad. You'll do anything to make it go away. Okay, somebody in sickle cell crisis, guess what? These red blood cells can't get into tissues all over their body, and what does that feel like? It hurts like hell everywhere. Okay, so it's a really terrible disease to have. So not only are the tissues being damaged, but it hurts terribly, terribly bad. So what do you do for somebody that is experiencing that intractable pain? What can you do? Well, opiates, right? That's really what you do. Some kind of analgesia so that they can't feel that pain. They go into sickle cell crisis routinely. What do they need routinely? Opiates, right? And the reason why I mention this is because usually when we think of somebody that needs opiates regularly, we think of them as a drug seeker, right? Or a drug abuser. But what about somebody that needs opiates to control pain that's produced by this terrible natural process in your body? Are they a drug seeker? No. The difference there is that when you're in a clinical practice and you have somebody with a chemical dependency and a drug seeker, you're really always kind of concerned about your own personal safety with them, because you never really know what they're going to do if you don't prescribe or administer the proper drugs that they want. Right? And so you just kind of treat them a little bit differently, but somebody that's in sickle cell crisis, should you treat them like a drug seeker or a chemical dependent? And the answer is no. These are people that need that medication just to be normal, right? And I think we talked about that in terms of Parkinson's disease. People with Parkinson's disease look like they're intoxicated, right? Or a drug seeker or substance abuser, but somebody with Parkinson's disease is not, right? And you shouldn't treat them and protect yourself the same way. So the same thing with sickle cell disease. Okay. All right, well, that's oxygen transport. What other gas are we interested in transporting in our blood? Carbon dioxide, right? From tissues into the alveolus and then out of your body. So here we have some tissue cells. I would guess this is an exam figure. Here we have some tissue cells. They're undergoing oxidative processes producing CO2. And that CO2 is going to diffuse from high concentration of these cells into the blood, into the plasma. And CO2 has a fairly high affinity for water. A lot can dissolve in water. So of all the CO2 that's produced, 10% dissolves in water. And compared to oxygen, it's probably less than 1%. So 10% can dissolve in water. Some of that CO2 that dissolves in plasma can enter a red blood cell, and it can combine with hemoglobin, right, to form carbaminohemoglobin. 20% of all carbon dioxide in your blood binds to that. So how much carbon dioxide is transported in your blood due to plasma and binding to hemoglobin? 30%, right? That's a pretty big number, but we're left with 70%. How is the rest of carbon dioxide transported in your blood? Well, we see carbon dioxide dissolves in plasma, can enter a red blood cell, and inside this red blood cell, it can combine with water to produce carbonic acid. Carbonic acid can then dissociate to make hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. Bicarbonate is highly soluble in water. Right, it's like a salt or a sugar. How much salt can you dissolve in water? A lot, right? You don't even want to measure it. Okay, and then this hydrogen ion here can combine with hemoglobin. And so most of the carbon dioxide that your body produces when it's transported in the blood is transported as bicarbonate ion. Right, and there's almost an unlimited amount of bicarbonate that you can put into water. So 70% is transported as bicarbonate. And that bicarbonate then can move out of the red blood cell. When an anion moves out of the red blood cell, what has to happen in order to maintain the proper electrical properties across the membrane? If an anion leaves, another anion has to enter to maintain the electrical properties of this cell. We call that a chloride shift. Right, so if somebody ever asks you a question, how is carbon dioxide carried in the blood? You're going to say, as the bicarbonate ion. Carbon dioxide is transported as bicarbonate. And that's maybe a little strange kind of consideration, because oxygen doesn't change into anything, it just binds to hemoglobin. All right, so this is in the tissues. Now, what happens when you get to the lungs? What do you want carbon dioxide to do in the lungs? You want it to leave your body, right? So here is in the lungs. So here is air in the alveolus, and we know that carbon dioxide in the alveolus or air is very, very low. So carbon dioxide is going to have a tendency to move by diffusion into this air. So here's that respiratory membrane, which is what, the endothelium of a capillary, very thin interstitial space, and then the simple squamous epithelium of the alveolus. It's a very short distance. All right, so if there's low CO2 in the alveolus, what about that CO2 that's dissolved in plasma? Move down its concentration gradient into the alveolus, right? And since carbon dioxide levels are decreasing, this carbaminohemoglobin dissociates into hemoglobin and carbon dioxide. This is like a double-ended arrow right here. So that releases CO2 in the red blood cell, and it's high in the red blood cell, low in the alveolus. Carbon dioxide is going to diffuse into the alveolus in the lung. Right? And as CO2 decreases, what about that carbonic anhydrase reaction? This carbon dioxide that we have in that reaction is going to diffuse into the alveolus, right? But because of Le Chatelier's principle, when we take CO2 away, how does this chemical reaction behave? Does it move to the left, or does it move to the right, or does it just stay there? It's going to move to the left to replenish the CO2 that has left the red blood cell. That's Le Chatelier's principle. All right, well, how does that happen? Well, carbonic anhydrase takes a bicarbonate anion and a hydrogen and makes carbonic acid out of it, right? And then carbonic acid dissociates into water and CO2. That CO2 then diffuses into the alveolus even more. All right, so basically, and then to replace this bicarbonate in the plasma moves into the red blood cell, and that process happens. Right, so this CO2 ends up in the alveolus in the form of carbon dioxide. And when bicarbonate anion enters this red blood cell, in order to maintain electrical neutrality, what has to happen? If an anion enters, another anion has to leave. This is what we call the reverse chloride shift, when blood is getting rid of CO2 in the lungs. All right, so anybody got a question on that? How is oxygen transported in the blood? Bound to hemoglobin. How is carbon dioxide transported in the blood? As bicarbonate anion. Two totally different kinds of things. And that's it for respiratory system. So is it helpful for tissues when there is a right shift in the oxygen binding saturation curve? Yes, more oxygen is unloaded into tissues when that happens. Okay, we're done at 12:05 in here, is that the deal? Okay, next chapter is renal system, renal physiology, and if you're going to learn anything about renal physiology, there is something that you have to, sign-in sheet is going around, and we're certainly not done with lecture today, sorry, if somebody's ready to take off. So, the kidney, you all know, is responsible for producing urine, and in so doing, it helps regulate blood pressure, and kidney does a whole bunch of other things. Right? What is that structural and functional unit of urine formation called? Okay, I heard some people say nephron, and I'm really glad to hear that. All right, so you got to know everything that you can possibly know about a nephron, and so we don't waste a lot of time. Next time, I want to make sure that I'm going to go over a nephron right now, right? And it might be kind of boring because it's just anatomy. Well, I'll try to put some physiology in there, okay? All right, so we're going to look at something like this. The picture in your textbook isn't too bad. The picture in the anatomy textbook is horrible. It's just way too confusing. All right, so I'm going to erase this. All right, so everybody's got to tell me, what's that structural and functional unit of urine formation? Nephron. What's the structural and functional unit of contraction? sarcomere. What's the functional and structural unit of communication between cells? The synapse. Yeah, what's the structural and functional unit of life? Yeah, so think about those terms, right? If you know how a cell works, you know about how almost everything in life works. If you know how a sarcomere works, you know how muscles contract. If you know how a nephron works, you know how the whole kidney works. So that's why it's so important. If we consider a nephron, it's made up of tubes. It's got tubes. And there are two kinds of tubes that make up a nephron. Right, the first kind we're going to call tubular elements. Tubular elements. Maybe some of you remember this from anatomy. Maybe I'll turn it up just a little bit. Tubular elements. And there's a fluid in these tubes, and you should know what that fluid is called. It is called filtrate. All right, so I'm going to jot this down right here, filtrate. And as it moves through the nephron, it gets processed and it becomes urine. All right, and then what happens to that urine? You excrete it from your body, right? Okay, so what are these tubular elements? This is going to be like knowing the stages of mitosis. Not only do you have to know the words, but you got to know the correct order. So if we're going to trace a drop of filtrate, I want to know what tube it goes to first, and then second and third all the way down the line. So, and I'm going to make a list right here. The first tubular element that is involved in making urine is called Bowman's capsule. That's what I call it. In textbooks, they've been converting that over to glomerular capsule. I don't know what your book does, right? Maybe it has glomerular capsule. Or maybe it's more traditional, like I am. All right, so what kind of fluid is in Bowman's capsule? Filtrate. Filtrate will move from Bowman's capsule into a tube that has a lot of twists and turns to it. The surface of the brain has a lot of valleys and hills. What do we call those things on the brain? Convolutions. So a tube that has a lot of twists and turns to it is a convoluted tube. Right? Convoluted just means really hard to follow. Hopefully I don't lecture like that, but I'm sure sometimes I do. So after Bowman's capsule, you get to a tube that's close to Bowman's capsule. We're going to call this the proximal. Proximal just means what? Close to something. Proximal, and it's convoluted. And it's a tube, tubule. Then that filtrate, you told me it's filtrate, moves into another tube, which is called the descending loop of Henle. I don't know what your book calls it, but there's a big effort to get rid of people's names from scientific talk, but I still use it. All right. So this loop of Henle takes filtrate from the cortex of the kidney down deep into the medulla of the kidney, if you can remember kind of what a kidney looks like. But then that filtrate goes back up into the cortex via the ascending loop of Henle. I didn't put loop. Loop of Henle. And then the ascending loop of Henle. Right, and then it goes into another convoluted tubule. And if there's a proximal one, then this is going to be the distal one. Right? Distal convoluted tubule. And then we're almost done. The very last tubular element is what we call the collecting duct. Is any of this ringing a bell for somebody? I hope a little bit. It's kind of like, how many chambers does a heart have, right? Okay, collecting duct. Now, in the collecting duct, we don't call that filtrate. We call that urine. Urine's in the collecting duct. What is the fluid in all of this stuff right here? Filtrate. All right, so this process right here is the physiology that we want to get to, but you got to know the anatomy first. All right, so that's a tubular element. What is another kind of element? We're going to call it a vascular element. What's the fluid in a vascular element? It's going to be blood. And I wrote really big over here. Let's see if I can sneak it in. There aren't many of these. So number two will be vascular elements. And don't forget, there's blood and a vascular element. Okay, There is an arteriole that's bringing blood into the nephron. And just like the nervous system, what do we call a nerve that brings information into the central nervous system? Afferent, right? So here is an afferent arteriole. Okay, and an arteriole always brings blood to what kind of vascular structure? You have artery, arteriole, venule, vein. What did I miss in the middle? Capillary, right? So this arteriole is bringing blood to a capillary. It's a very special leaky capillary, so it's got a special name. It's called the glomerulus. All right, you guys don't have a practicum in lab, but it's probably good that you know how to pronounce this because then you know how to spell it, right? It is what? Glomerulus. I think we should all say that. Glomerulus, right? Glomerulus is how you say it. All right, glomerulus. That's a capillary, right? And so I'm going to put that down over here. Capillary number one. Right. Usually then, from a capillary, blood flows into a venule, but in this particular case, in the nephron, it goes into another arteriole. And we're going to call this the efferent arteriole. And where does an arteriole always bring blood? An arteriole always brings blood to a capillary. And so here is another capillary. We're going to call these the peritubular capillaries, and this is capillary number two in this particular circuit. And then after this peritubular capillary, it just goes into a venule, like what you're familiar with. All right, so that's all the vascular elements. So here we have a capillary, a segment of something, another blood vessel, and then another capillary. What kind of system? Right, do we call this right here? Instead of one capillary, there are two back to back before it goes to the heart. That's a portal blood system, like between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary, between digestive organs and the liver, right? The hepatic portal system, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system, okay, and then we have one in the nephron. All right, so let's draw this out, and I might need your help, but that's okay because here's the list of things we want to draw out. Yeah. Oh, we don't. Ah, okay, it is time to go. Okay, next time we're going to draw it out. As a matter of fact, maybe you should draw it out before Thursday, okay, because that's exactly where I'm going to start. You know, I really want to get through this chapter because we want to talk about sex, and that's the last one, so just got to keep pushing.